His presence at the reception was an incredible coup for Max, whose obsession with social climbing had become even more pathological in recent years, although the great man had declined to attend the ceremony itself earlier in the day, citing an unmissable appointment with his chiropodist. The former Taoiseach, Jack Lynch, was there too, keeping a careful distance from Charles Haughey, who was standing by the bar giving an uncanny impression of one of those unsettling fairground figures, carved from porcelain, whose bodies remain still while their eyes move slowly around the room. Sport was represented by Tipperary's Jimmy Doyle, who had won 6 All-Ireland hurling medals for his county over recent years. Literature by Ernest Gabler and J.P. Dunleavy. While at a table in the corner, my adoptive father's new wife, Rosalind, was sucking up to Maureen O'Hara, who smiled politely but kept checking her watch, no doubt wondering when might be a good time to ask the concierge to hail her a taxi. I found it impossible to concentrate on what Dev was saying, for my attention was focused almost exclusively on Julian, who was standing next to an anxious-looking Archbishop Ryan, while one of the bridesmaids did her best to engage him in conversation. Usually he would have been flirting away, Julian, that is not the Archbishop, wondering whether he should take her back to his room for a quickie before dinner, or wait until afterwards when he could put a bit more time and effort into the seduction. But for once, he appeared completely uninterested. Whenever I caught his eye, he gave me a look that combined disappointment and murderous intent before turning away and ordering another drink. There was a part of me that wanted to take him aside to explain why I had done the things I had done, or indeed hadn't done. But I knew there was no point. There was nothing I could say that would make him forgive me. Nothing that could possibly excuse my actions. Our friendship, such as it had been, was over. When I finally managed to escape the president, who was holding forth in quite graphic terms about the state of his bunions, I looked around for a quiet corner where I might find a canopy forked to stick through my heart. Whichever way I turned, however, I found myself being leaped upon by another of our 300 guests, most of whom were complete strangers to me, each one wanting to shake my hand but let me know that I had condemned myself to 50 years of trying without success to satisfy the little woman.
"Tonight's the night, eh, boy?"
said the old men, whose leery smiles I wanted to punch off their wrinkly old faces.
"Getting a few pints into you to build up the old energy, wa?"
"You'll be starting a family soon,"
said their wives, practically lactating at the idea of my impregnating Alice at regular intervals over the years ahead.
"Have 3 in 3 years, that's my advice to you. A boy, a girl, and an either-or. A gentleman's family. And then let that be an end to the whole filthy business."
One even leaned forward and whispered in my ear,
"After that, I would suggest separate bedrooms, to keep the devil at bay."
I felt surrounded by people and noise, overwhelmed by the stench of perfume and alcohol and suffocated by the haze of cigarette smoke. I was like a child, trapped at a carnival, unable to find my way to the exit, my heart starting to beat faster as the crowds closed in around me. Finally, battling forward in the direction of the lobby, I turned to find Alice standing next to me, looking equally dazed and uncomfortable. She smiled, but I noticed the shadow of some private anxiety crossing her face.
"We should have kept the numbers down, shouldn't we?"
I said, leaning in and having to shout to make myself heard.
"I don't know who half these people are."
"Friends of Max's," she said, shaking her head. "It didn't look so bad on paper, but I can barely find time to talk to my actual friends. The average age is 60+. There's a man over there wearing an actual colostomy bag outside his trousers."
"Not anymore. A child ran into him and burst it."
"Oh, good Lord. It's a wedding."
"We could sound the fire alarm," I suggested, "and then choose who we let back in afterwards. They need to have all their own hair and teeth and a reasonable chance of looking good in the photographs later."
She gave me a half smile, but didn't seem pleased. "I knew I shouldn't have given him free rein," she muttered. "I should have learned from... Oh, God. Sorry, Cyril."
"What?"
I asked.
"It doesn't matter."
"No, tell me." She had the good grace to look embarrassed. "I was going to say that I should have learned from last time," she said.
until I realized what an inappropriate thing that was to say today of all days. "Oh, trust me," I said. "It's tame compared to some of the things I've said today." "People keep giving me money too," she added. "In envelopes. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with it." "So I gave them all to him," she added, nodding towards the bar. "Charlie Haughey," I said, raising my voice appalled. "You gave all our money to him? We'll never see it again. It'll all be sent up north to the provost." "Julian," she said, shaking her head. "I gave it to Julian." "Oh, all right. That's not so bad, I suppose." "Actually, I have another one here," she said, pulling an envelope from one of the mysterious compartments of her dress. "You wouldn't bring it over to him, would you?" "No," I said, quicker than I'd intended. There was no chance that I was going anywhere near her brother. "Actually, I was just going out for some air." "Are you all right? You look a little red in the face." "It's just too stuffy in here, that's all. I'll be back." I tried to leave, but she put a hand out to stop me. "Wait," she said. "I need to talk to you." "I'll be back in a few minutes, promise." "No, I need to talk to you now." "Why?" I asked, surprised by the urgency in her tone. "Is something wrong?" "What's he said to you?"
"What's who said to me?"
"No one."
"What's no one said to me? What are you talking about, Cyril?"
I glanced across the room at Julian, who was watching us now while wearing a furious expression, and I started to feel annoyed by his attitude. "If you didn't want me to marry her," I thought, "then you could have stopped me. But now that I've gone through with it, don't fucking look at me like that." She opened her mouth to speak, but before she could, her mother Elizabeth appeared arm in arm with a boyfriend young enough to be her grandson, and I saw my chance to escape.
"Don't leave," Elizabeth purred, taking my hand and holding on to it. "You haven't met Ryan yet."
"I haven't," I agreed, reaching out and shaking the boy's hand. He was young, certainly, but if I had to be honest, I didn't think he was all that special. He looked a bit like Mickey Rooney in the Andy Hardy films, only not quite as tall. Halfway across the room, I could see Charles watching the pair of them, perhaps recalling his and Elizabeth's infamous trysts of 1952 that had led to such trouble.
"Marriage is such an outdated institution, don't you think?"
said Ryan, looking at me and Alice as if he had just been confronted by a pair of turds in human form. "That's an odd thing to say," said Alice. "To a bride on her wedding day, I mean."
"Ryan is just joking," said Elizabeth, bursting out laughing. She'd clearly won the award for first drunk at the wedding. "He's from Vermont," she added, as if this explained everything.
"I was in Vermont once," said Charles,
slipping in between the two of them and using his elbows to separate them.
"I spent a few weeks in Newport. On business,"
he added, dramatically.
"Newport isn't Rhode Island," said Ryan. "Different state."
"I'm aware of that," said Charles, humbled. "I was making a non sequitur. I was in Vermont once, and in other news, I was in Newport, Rhode Island, on a different occasion."
"This is Charles Avery," said Elizabeth, thrilled beyond belief to have the chance to show off her little treasure. "And this is Ryan Wilson."
"Hey," said Ryan. "Good afternoon," said Charles.
"Charles is Cyril's father," said Elizabeth.
"Adoptive father," said Charles and I in unison. "He's not a real Avery," added Charles after a short pause. "Anyway, what brings you here, young man? Are you engaged in some sort of student exchange?"
"No, I am Elizabeth's lover," he replied without missing a beat, and, to give him credit, even Charles was impressed by such un-Irish frankness.
"Fair enough,"
he said, for once looking a little deflated. I wasn't sure why he was bothering, to be honest. It wasn't as if he had any interest in reigniting things with Elizabeth. He told me once, after all, that he thought it was a mistake for any man to marry a woman old enough to be his wife.
"I'll be right back," I whispered to Alice. "Wait," she said, turning and gripping my arm. "I need to talk to you.
when I'm back.
It's really important. Just give me...
Jesus Christ, Alice, I said irritably, shaking her off, the first time I had ever raised my voice to her.
Whoa, buddy,
said Ryan, and I shot him a contemptuous glance. 5 minutes, I said to Alice. Call of nature. As I left the room, I found my head turning, as if independent of my will, towards Julian again, but he had his back to me now and was leaning over the bar with his head in his hands. There was something about the way his shoulders were shuddering that made me think he was crying, but I dismissed this as an impossibility. I had never seen Julian weep in his entire life. Not even when he returned home from the loving embrace of his IRA kidnappers, short a thumb, a toe, and an ear. Once in the lobby, I felt able to breathe again. But when I saw Dana making her way towards me, arms outstretched for a hug and some form of unspeakable musical congratulation emerging from her ruby lips, I turned on my heels and ran towards the staircase, taking them two at a time and breaking into a run as I ascended to the fifth-floor penthouses where the bridal suite held pride of place at the centre of the corridor. I fumbled around for my key, then quickly closed the door behind me as I ripped off my tie, making my way to the bedroom, where a cool breeze was blowing through an open window, inhaling and exhaling deeply until I began to feel my heart rate return to normal. I sat down on the corner of the bed, but it had been covered with such a delicate throw and handfuls of rose petals that it only served to deepen my despair, and so I stood up almost immediately, moving over to the sofa. I twisted the gold ring, newly placed on the fourth finger of my left hand. It came loose a little too easily, and I held it in the palm of my hand, judging its weight, before laying it on a side table next to an unopened bottle of red wine. Alice and I had spent an entire Saturday afternoon shopping for the rings, and it had been fun. We'd spent more money than we'd intended, and by the end of the day, when we were having dinner, I felt such strong affection towards her that I began to wonder whether our friendship might ultimately blossom into love. But of course I was deluding myself. For love was one thing, but desire was something else entirely. A part of me regretted having told Julian anything. Another part resented the fact that I had been forced to hide my true self so long. He said in the church that if I told him the truth from the start, he wouldn't have cared, but I didn't believe that for a moment. Not for a single moment. When we'd first shared a room at Belvedere College, he would have asked for a transfer if I had explained my feelings for him. And even if he had shown any kindness or understanding towards me at the time, word would have soon got out, and the other boys would have made my life a misery. The priests would have expelled me, and I would have had no home to go to. If only Charles and Max had never met, I told myself. If only the lives of the Averys and the Woodbeads had never intersected in the first place. My nature might not have turned out any different, but at least I wouldn't have found myself in this terrible mess. Or would there have simply been another Julian? Was there someone else like him out there somewhere under whose spell I would have fallen? Another Alice? It was impossible to know. Trying to understand it all was giving me a headache. I walked towards the pair of French doors that opened onto the balcony, peering outside tentatively like a minor member of the royal family when the crowds have all gone home. Looking across the treetops into the parkland of St. Stephen's Green was a vantage point that I had never enjoyed before. But this was Dublin, the nation's capital, the place of my birth, and a city I loved at the heart of a country I loathed. A town filled with good-hearted innocence, miserable bigots, adulterous husbands, conniving churchmen, paupers who received no help from the state, and millionaires who sucked the lifeblood from it. Glancing down, I watched as the cars drove around the green, the horses and traps filled with tourists, and the taxis pulled up to the hotel. The trees were bursting into full verdure, and I wished that I could simply spread my arms and take flight, soar above them and look down on the lake before ascending into the clouds like Icarus, happy to be scorched by the sun and disintegrate into nothingness. The sun was out, and I removed my jacket and waistcoat, throwing them back into the living room, where they landed on the side of a chair. My shoes felt tight on my feet, and I kicked them off too, followed quickly by my socks, and the feeling of the stone balcony beneath my bare feet was curiously invigorating. I breathed in the fresh afternoon air, and a sense of calm began to take me over. Had the balcony extended further across the street, I would have been able to walk out and turn my head to the left to see the corners of Dáil Éireann, where Julian and I had enjoyed one of our earliest adventures together. Further ahead, further than I could possibly see, I might have spotted Dartmouth Square and the house where I had been reared, the same one that Maud and I had been forced to quit in disgrace after Charles's incarceration, and where I had laid eyes on Julian for the first time after watching in bewilderment as Alice ran screaming from my adoptive mother's second-floor office. Where I had fallen in love, before I even knew what those words meant. As I dwelled on these memories, and felt the breeze lift my spirits, it seemed entirely natural for me to take my shirt off, and allow the wind to blow against my chest. In fact, it was so pleasurable, so hypnotic, that I undid my belt and removed my trousers, feeling neither shame nor self-consciousness, until I was standing there, several hundred feet above the streets of Dublin, wearing nothing but my underwear. I glanced to my right, but the buildings at the northern tip of the green prevented me from enjoying a clear view of the flat on Chatham Street, where I had once lived with Albert Thatcher and been forced to deal with the sound of his headboard banging against my wall night after night. To go back 7 years, I thought, and do things differently. I had gone this far, I told myself. What had I to lose? I reached down and removed my underwear, kicking them back inside the room, and felt a little giddy as I stood on the balcony, leaning over and stared across the top of the city, naked as I had been on the day of my birth. Had I been able to see forever, I could have looked out to the other side of Dublin itself, through Kildare and Tipperary, and onwards to Cork City, then into the toe of the country, at Galeen itself, where, although I did not know it at the time, my grandparents were being buried side by side that same afternoon, having been run over by a speeding car as they left the funeral mass of Father James Munro, the man who had banished my mother from the town some 28 years earlier. I would have seen my 6 uncles standing next to each other at the gravesides, as they ever did in ascending order of age and stupidity, and my own father, the man who had planted me in my mother's womb, standing nearby, accepting the condolences of neighbours, and wondering whether he would be expected to buy a round of drinks for everyone when they made their way to Flanavan's pub later. I would have seen it all, had I been able to see. But I could see none of it because I had spent my entire life blind and deaf and mute and ignorant, devoid of any senses save the one that governed my sexual compulsions, and that had brought me to this terrible place from which, I was certain, there could be no return. It was easy to lift my body to the top of the barrier and swing my legs over the side, so easy that I wondered why I had not done it years before. I looked down at the street below, at my own nakedness hovering above it, not a soul looking up to the heavens to watch me. I rocked back and forth a little, allowing my centre of gravity and the breeze to do their work. My hands gripped the ironwork, and then, gradually, they started to loosen. "Let go," I told myself. "Let go. Just fall." I took a deep breath, and the last thought that I allowed to pass through my mind was not about my mother, my adoptive parents, Julian, or any of the strangers that I had been forced to fuck in darkness over the years. My last thought was directed towards Alice, in apology for what I had done to her, and how it would take this to set her free again. And somehow I felt entirely at peace, as I took my hands away and allowed my body to lean forward. And then a child's voice, calling from the street below.
"Look, Mammy, that man has no clothes on!"
I pulled back in fright. My hands gripped the ironwork once again. I heard shouts from the people on St. Stephen's Green. screams, excitement and delirium, hilarity and horror. I looked down as the crowd gathered, and the vertigo that had eluded me before kicked in now, almost causing me to fall when I didn't want to. And it took all my strength and focus to swing around, to ignore the shrieks and laughter from below as the people of the city caught sight of me. I fell back into the room and lay gasping on the carpet and couldn't quite understand why I was naked. A moment later, the phone rang. I lifted it, expecting either the voice of the hotel manager or a guard issue corner summoned in from the street beyond. But no, it was just Alice. Calm, completely unaware of what I had just tried to do, her tone filled with compassion and love.
"There you are," she said. "What are you doing up there? I thought you said you'd only be a few minutes."
"Sorry," I told her. "I left my wallet up here, that's all. I'm on my way back down now."
"No," she said. "Don't come down. I'm coming up. There's something I want to talk to you about. It's important."
This again, I thought.
"What has Julian said?"
I asked. There was a long pause.
"We'll talk upstairs," she said. "When we're alone. Let me come down to you."
"No, Cyril," she insisted. "Just stay where you are, all right? I'm on my way up." And with that she was gone. I put the receiver down and looked down at my wedding suit, scattered on the floor now. It would only be a couple of minutes before she was walking through the door, and others would surely be here in less time than that when the crowd from the street reported what they had seen. So I did the only thing that I could think of. I reached for my suitcase, pulled out a change of clothes and threw them on, pulling open the hand luggage I brought with me for the honeymoon. I took out the only things I needed, my wallet and my passport. I put a hat on and pulled it down over my forehead, glancing at my wedding ring where I'd left it but deciding not to pick it up. Leaving the room, I didn't go towards the staircase, but to the other end of the corridor, to the elevator that the staff used when bringing room service meals up and down between the floors. Glancing back down the corridor as the doors sealed shut behind me, I felt certain that I saw a burst of white, a billowing cloud of wedding dress, as Alice appeared at the top of the staircase. But then I was locked into silence and transported down into the bowels of the building, where a private staff entrance led me out onto the corner of Kildare Street. A crowd had gathered. They were looking up towards the roof of the building, waiting for the crazy naked man to reappear, half of them hoping that he would be saved, half of them hoping that he would jump. There was nothing left for me here. I knew that much. So what else could I do but follow my own advice and get out of town?
Part 2. Exile. 1980. Into the Annex. By the River Amstel. I could see the argument taking place from halfway down the street. A giant of a man wearing a heavy overcoat with fur trim across the shoulders and, perversely, a tattered, grey tweed deerstalker hat. Next to him, a young boy, perhaps a third his size, in denim jeans and a dark blue jacket with a white T-shirt underneath. They were arguing loudly, the boy shouting at the older man, his arms flailing in the air as he grew more and more enraged. When the man spoke, his tone was obviously controlled and indisputably more threatening. After a moment, the boy turned around to storm off, but before he could get more than a few feet away, the man reached out and grabbed him roughly by the collar, pinning him up against the wall and punching him hard in the stomach. The boy crumpled to the ground, his knees rising to protect himself from further assault when he fell to the wet pavement. He turned his head and his body jerked forward as he vomited into the gutter. When he was finished, the man reached down and dragged him back to his feet before whispering something in his ear and discarding him roughly, the boy's body falling back into the pool of sick as his attacker walked away into the darkness. Throughout all of this, I had held back, having no desire to get involved in a street fight. But now that the boy was alone, I made my way quickly towards him. He looked up in fear as I approached, and I could see tears streaming down his face. He was young,
15 at most. "Are you all right?" I asked, reaching a hand out to help him up. But he flinched, as if I was intent on hurting him too, and pushed himself back towards the wall. "Can I help you?" He shook his head, pulling himself painfully to his feet, and with one arm pressed against his wounded stomach, shuffled away, turning the corner in the direction of the Amstel River. I watched him go before putting the key in my door and stepping inside. The whole incident had taken only a minute or two, and just as quickly I put it out of my mind, giving no further thought to what had caused the fight or where the boy might go next. Pulling myself out of the shit. Incredibly, I never learned to ride a bicycle until I lived in Amsterdam. For some, the sight of a man in his mid-30s cycling unsteadily around the Vondelpark while another ran behind, ready to catch him should he fall, was like something out of a Chaplin film. But this was how I spent many weekend afternoons during the summer of 1980. After causing a multiple pile-up near the Rijksmuseum and almost sliding beneath the axles of a tram in Frederiksplein, I was advised to sit for my Verkeers diploma, which most children passed by grade 7 in school, and failed 3 times. A record, I was told, by the disbelieving instructor, receiving stitches in my right knee after a particularly nasty collision with a lamppost before finally passing and being given the uncertain freedom of the roads. My first extended solo cycle took place a few weeks later when I left the city for Naarden, a journey of about 90 minutes, where I was to meet Bastian's parents, Arjan and Edda, for the first time. Bastian, who was taking the train from Utrecht after work, had promised to be there early in order to make the introductions, so I felt anxious when I arrived a little ahead of schedule. I had never met a boyfriend's parents before, and wasn't sure about the etiquette of the situation. Even if I had been talking to the one member of my family who I presumed was still alive, Charles, I doubted that he would have even entertained the idea of such an encounter. A long road, humped by unhelpful rocks and random potholes, led to the Vandenberg farm, and I found my unsteady cycling further threatened by a pair of dogs who came charging in my direction the moment they caught sight of me, barking loudly and offering no clue as to whether they were excited or enraged by my appearance. Although I generally liked dogs, I had never owned one, and their ambiguous greeting, not to mention their determination to scamper around me, led to my falling off once again and landing in an enormous steaming pile of shit, the scent and texture of which suggested that it had not long escaped the bowels of some aged incontinent cow. I looked down at my brand new chinos and the parallel lines t-shirt that was my pride and joy, and could have wept at the filthy brown streaks smeared across Debbie Harry's perfect face. "You fucking fuckers," I muttered as the dogs came over and, feigning innocence, wagged their tails in acknowledgement of their small victory. The larger of the two cocked his leg and took a piss against my fallen bike, an indignity that I thought was a little much. Up ahead, I heard a voice call out a stream of words and narrowed my eyes to see a woman standing outside the farmhouse, hands on hips, waving towards me. From this distance, I couldn't make out what she was saying, but guessed that this was Bastian's mother, and had no choice but to pick myself up and, my attackers in tow, make my way towards her. As I got closer, I noticed her eyes were lingering in faint amusement on my soiled clothes. "You must be the Irish boy," she said, nibbling at her lower lip as she sized me up. "Cyril," I said, not bothering to extend my filthy hand. "And you must be Mrs. Vandenberg." "Call me Edda," she said. "You know that you're covered in cow shit, yes?" "I do," I said. "I fell off my bike." "What kind of person falls off a bike? Have you been drinking?" "No. Well, not today, anyway. I had a few beers last night, but I'm pretty sure they're..." "It doesn't matter," she said, interrupting me. "In Holland, even drunk people can cycle without falling off. I've been known to fall asleep with my head on my handlebars and still make it home safely. Come inside. Arjan is at the top field, but he'll be down soon." "I can't," I told her, looking down at my ruined clothes. "Not like this, anyway." Maybe I should go home and come back another day. This is a farm, Cyril, she said with a shrug. There's nothing we're not used to. Come, follow me. We went inside the house, and I kicked my boots off at the door, not wanting to cause any unnecessary mess. She took me through the living room and down a narrow corridor that led to a bathroom before opening a nearby cabinet and handing me a towel that felt to the touch as if it had been used, washed, dried, and returned to its shelf 10,000 times. "You can take a shower in here," she said. "Next door is Bastian's old bedroom, and he still keeps some clothes in the wardrobe. Change into something when you're finished." "Thank you," I said, closing the door behind me before turning to my own reflection in the mirror and mouthing the word, "fuck," with as much quiet intensity as I could muster. I stripped quickly and stepped into the stall. The water pressure was abysmal, and the temperature had only two settings, freezing and scalding. But somehow I managed to wash all the crap from my face and hands, dissolving the single bar of soap into nothingness as I scrubbed myself. I turned around at one point to allow the water to cascade down my back and legs and, to my astonishment, could make out the figure of Mrs. Vandenberg in the bathroom, lifting my soiled clothes from the floor and throwing them over her arm. Before leaving, she turned and stared directly at my naked figure before nodding in satisfaction and exiting the bathroom. Most odd, I thought. When I was finished, I peeped outside to make sure the car door was empty before darting into the next room and closing the door behind me. There was something faintly erotic about being alone in Bastian's childhood bedroom, and I couldn't stop myself from lying down on the single bed that had been his for 18 years before he left for university. I tried to imagine him falling asleep there as a teenager, fantasizing about bare-chested swimmers or floppy-haired Dutch pop stars as he embraced his sexuality instead of running from it. It was in this bed that he had lost his virginity at the age of 15 to a boy from his local football team, when he spent the night there after a cup final match. When he told me that story, a softness in his expression, a dampness in his eyes at the blissful memory, I had been torn between grudging respect and overwhelming jealousy, for I simply couldn't compare my own early experiences with his. The fact that the boy, Gregor, remained a vague presence in his life still was astonishing to me, for until meeting Bastian himself, I had never encountered a lover twice. From the start, Bastian spoke freely about his love life. He hadn't slept with many people, no more than a dozen or so, but most of them had been boys with whom he had gone on to form some type of subsequent relationship, sometimes romantic, sometimes as nothing more than friends. A few still lived in Amsterdam, and if they met by chance on the street, they would throw their arms around each other and exchange a kiss while I stood awkwardly by their side, still alarmed to witness such open public displays of affection between two men, always assuming that the people around us, who could not have cared less, might turn on us. Despite how open he had been with me, for Bastian never lied or withheld anything, I found it much more difficult to be honest with him about my past. It wasn't that I was ashamed of the large number of sexual partners I had had over the years, but I had come to realize that there was something rather tragic about my pathological promiscuity. For, yes, I might have fucked countless boys, but when it came to romance, I was still a virgin. Slowly, as I grew to love and trust him, I unburdened myself of the story of my once obsessive love for Julian Woodbead, sparing him some of the more pitiful stories out of fear that I might scare him away. And a month after we started dating, when it was becoming clear that this was no passing fancy on either of our parts, I told him the story of my ridiculous 3-hour marriage. Listening in amazement, torn between horror and hilarity, he finally shook his head in disbelief, unable to understand why I would have put myself and Alice through such incredible deceit. "What's wrong with you people?" he asked, looking at me as if I was clinically insane. "What's wrong with Ireland? Are you all just fucking nuts over there? Is that it? Don't you want each other to be happy?" "No," I said, finding my country a difficult one to explain. "No, I don't think we do." Standing up now, I took a pair of jeans and a denim shirt from inside the bedroom wardrobe and put them on. They hung a little loose on me,
for Bastian had a bigger build and was more muscular than I, but it felt exciting to wear his clothes. Once, on the second occasion that I had slept at his flat, I hadn't enough time to return home to change for work, and he had offered me a pair of his own underwear. Wearing them throughout that day had been such an erotic experience that I found myself masturbating in the toilets at work a couple of hours later to discharge my excitement, a shocking sacrilege considering where I was employed. Wearing his clothes now gave me a similar thrill, although I resisted any urge to lay hands on myself in case his mother marched in unannounced once again. We'd only known each other 10 minutes, after all, and she'd already seen me naked. She didn't need to see me jerking off, too. Making my way back down the corridor, I stepped inside the kitchen, where a man with a gentle expression sat reading a newspaper. He had deep, furrowed lines on his face, and wore his overcoat despite being indoors, but took it off with a sigh when he saw me.
"Edda tells me that you fell in the shit," he said, folding the paper in half and placing it on the table before him.
He wore his sleeves long, I noticed, despite the hot weather.
"I did," I admitted.
"It happens," he said with a shrug. "We all fall in the shit many times during our lives. The trick is pulling ourselves out again."
I nodded, unsure if he was being philosophical or simply stating facts.
"My son should be here," he said when I introduced myself. "I hope you don't think we brought him up with such bad manners."
"He must have been delayed," I said. "He's not a good timekeeper at the best of times."
"He never has been," said
Aryan, asserting his primacy over me.
Edda came over and placed 2 mugs of coffee on the table, and I sat down, glancing around the room.
Although the Vandenberg house was small, they had filled every nook and cranny with curiosities accumulated over the years. The walls might have been papered or painted. It was impossible to tell with the collection of family photographs that adorned them. The shelves were dipping with books, while a stand next to a record player held an enormous pile of long player albums. It was no wonder, I told myself, that my boyfriend had left it such a calm and well-adjusted adult as opposed to the completely fucked-up creature that I had been when I started to make my way in Dublin. Nevertheless, it astonished me that a couple who had witnessed so much horror in the world could manage to find beauty in it ever again. I knew their story, of course. On our 4th date, over pints of beer at our favourite bar McIntyre's on Herrengracht, Bastian had told me how his parents had left their wedding ceremony in 1942 with the words of the Sheva Brachot still ringing in their ears, and within the hour had been rounded up by the Nazis, along with some 300 other Jews, before being sent to the Dutch transit camp at Westerbork. They remained there for almost a month, catching sight of each other only once when their paths crossed during a work detail, before Aryan was dispatched to Bergen-Belsen and Edda to Auschwitz. Journeys and experiences that they somehow survived before being liberated by the British and Russian armies respectively towards the end of the war. It was 1946 before they found each other again, by chance, in that same place, that same bar, when it had been called De Tweepaarden. Their families wiped out, Edda had found work there as a waitress, and Aryan happened to stop in one evening with his 1st week's wages in search of oblivion. Almost exactly 9 months later, their joyful and unexpected reunion had resulted in Bastian, their only child. Although I'm sure that Bastian had told his parents where I had been working for the past 2 years, they feigned surprise when I mentioned it. I had rather dreaded the moment, being so conscious of their histories, but they seemed interested, despite claiming never to have visited the house itself, for reasons they did not explain. After moving on to completely different subjects for the next 10 minutes, however, Aryan surprised me by returning to it, mentioning that he had been in the same class at school with Peter van Pels during the late 1930s, while Edda had once attended a birthday party with Margot Frank, although she had never, to the best of her knowledge, met Anne.
"Peter and I played football on the same team," Aryan explained, looking out the window towards the fields beyond, where the dogs were chasing each other in another burst of energy. "He wanted to be a striker, but our coach insisted on his playing in defence. He had no great skill, but he was fit. So fit that he could run anyone off the pitch."
My sister Edith came to watch the match every Saturday morning because she liked him, although she was too shy to say so. He was too old for her anyway. My father would never have allowed it. Peter was always late for training. It became frustrating to me. I decided one day to have it out with him, but that, of course, was the day that he disappeared forever. Into the annex.
I felt both moved and startled by this information. To know that the man seated opposite me had such a personal connection with someone whose picture I saw every day and whose story had become such a part of my life. I glanced towards Edda, but she kept her back to me. Eventually, however, she turned around, clearing her throat but not making eye contact with me as she spoke, as if she was an actress on a stage reciting a monologue.
"Mr. Frank ran a spice company," she declared. "Mr. Frank was a gentleman, a dear friend of my father's. Whenever we stopped in, Mr. Frank always asked after my mother's health, for she was frequently ill. She suffered with asthmatic attacks, and he kept a jar of toffees behind Miss Gee's desk for children such as I. Years later, after the diary was published, I saw Mr. Frank once in Dam Square and wanted to approach him to remind him of Edda, who had been in his office many times as a girl, but I hesitated. I watched as he passed among the tourists, unseen, jostled by some of them. A man wearing an Ajax T-shirt thrust a camera into his hands and asked him to take a photograph of him and his wife, and afterwards he took the camera back without so much as a thank you, as if Mr. Frank existed for no other reason than to do his bidding. I wondered what any of the people in the square that day would do if they knew that here was a man among men. And then, his head bowed, he simply disappeared from sight. It was the only time I ever saw Mr. Frank in the flesh after the war. There were so many questions that I wanted to ask, but I was uncertain how intrusive my curiosity might be. In the 4 years that I'd lived and worked in Amsterdam, I had met dozens of survivors of the death camps and formed professional connections with many of them due to my work at the museum, but there was something more intimate to me about this moment. For here were two people who had gone through the worst of all possible experiences and survived it. And I was in love with their son, and he, to my utter astonishment, appeared to be in love with me, too.
"How can you bear it?" asked Edda, sitting down now and raising her voice, partly in anger and partly in bewilderment. "Working there, I mean, spending every day in such a place? Does it not become painful? Or is it worse than that? Have you simply become immune to it all?"
"No," I said, choosing my words carefully. "It fascinates me. Growing up in Ireland, I knew very little of what had taken place during the war. They didn't teach us about it. And now I learn more every day. At the museum, our education plan is always growing. We welcome school groups all the time. It's my job to help educate them about the things that happened there."
"And how can you do that?" she asked, sounding genuinely perplexed, "when you understand absolutely nothing about it yourself."
I said nothing. It was true that I could not possibly understand as they understood, could not feel as they felt. But since arriving in Amsterdam and finding work as a junior curator at the museum, my life had begun to hold meaning for me for the first time. I was 35 years old and felt that I belonged somewhere at last, that I was of use. The house mattered to me more than I could possibly say. It was a place steeped in historical danger, and yet, perversely, it was also a place where I felt utterly safe.
"Of course it's important," she continued with a sigh. "I don't dispute that. But to spend all day there with those ghosts..."
She shivered, and Aryan reached across to place his hand atop hers. His sleeve rode up a little now, and when my eyes glanced towards it, he pushed it back down.
"And why are you interested, anyway? Are there no Irish Jews who you can patronize?"
"Not many," I admitted, stung by her choice of verb.
"There are not many anywhere," said Aryan. "I know all about your country," she said. "I've read about it. I've heard about it. It sounds like a backward place. A people with no empathy for anyone. Why do you let your priests decide everything for you?" Because they always have, I suppose.
What a ridiculous answer,
she said with an irritated laugh.
Still, at least you abandoned it.
I think you were clever to do that.
I didn't abandon it, I said, surprised to feel unexpected stirrings of patriotism in a soul that I had always thought devoid of such parochial bullshit.
I left it, that's all.
Is there a difference?
I think so.
You'll go back some day, I expect.
All Irish boys go home to their mothers in the end, don't they? If they know who their mothers are, perhaps.
Well, I couldn't do what you do, she said.
I don't even like visiting Amsterdam anymore. I haven't been near the Westerkerk in years, and I loved climbing to the summit when I was a girl. It's like...
And here she turned to her husband.
Elspeth's son. What's his name again?
Henrik, said Arjen.
Yes, Henrik.
The son of a friend of ours, a historian.
And he has spent the last 2 years working in the museum at Auschwitz.
How can he do such a thing?
How can he bear it? It baffles me.
Would you ever consider giving a talk at the house? I asked, an idea coming half-formed into my head and translating itself into words before I had a chance to consider them properly.
Perhaps to some of the children who visit.
I don't think so, Cyril, said Arjen, shaking his head. What could I say anyway? That Peter van Pels was a good footballer? That my sister, like Anne Frank, had a crush on him? This is almost 40 years ago, remember. I don't have anything to say that would be of interest to anyone.
Then perhaps you could talk about your time at...
He stood up, pushing his chair back with such force that it screeched across the tiled floor, making me wince at the sound. Looking up, it struck me how big he was, how hard he had worked to keep himself in shape. Physically, he had a similar build to the man who had beaten up the boy outside my apartment a few days earlier, but his heft belied his gentle nature, and I felt ashamed to make the comparison. No one spoke for a few moments, until Arjen turned around and made his way slowly towards the sink, turning on the taps as he began to rinse out the teacups.
"You shouldn't lose touch with your home," said Edda finally, reaching out and taking my hand in hers, her tone softening now. "It's where all your memories were made.
Perhaps you should bring Bastian sometime.
Does he want to see it?"
"He says he does," I said,
glancing at the clock and hoping that he would arrive soon. "Maybe someday. We'll see. The truth is, I'm happy in Amsterdam. Holland feels more like home to me than Ireland ever did. But I'm not sure if I could ever go back. The truth is, when I left, and then to my relief, before I could reveal too much of myself, I heard footsteps ascending the steps outside to the front door. There was a quick, triple tap on the woodwork before the sound of the latch being pulled, and there was Bastian, red-faced from rushing to get there, marching in and hugging both his parents in a display of family love that was utterly foreign to me, before turning and smiling at me in a way that said there was no one else in the world he wanted to see more at that moment than me. By Rokin. I was seated in the window of a bar in Rokin, waiting for my friend Danique to arrive. The woman who had originally hired me as a junior curator. She had left her job at the Anne Frank House a year earlier for a position at the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., but was back in Amsterdam for a week or two to attend a family wedding. I had forgotten to bring a book with me and was staring out the window, my eyes drawn to the bar across the street. It was a popular hangout for rent boys, a darkened hovel full of easy trade, lonely middle-aged men with wedding rings in their coat pockets, half-finished bottles of beer and instantaneous pickups. In my first months in the city, at my lowest depths following my exile from Dublin, I had found myself there once or twice in search of the oblivion of uncomplicated sex. Looking across now, out of prurient interest, I saw two men emerge through the front door, one who looked familiar to me, one who did not. The first was the man who had punched the boy in the street outside my apartment a few weeks earlier. I knew him from his girth,
his fur-trimmed overcoat and his ridiculous deerstalker. He took a cigarette from his pocket and lit it quickly as the other man, a 40-something with sallow skin and a Manchester United T-shirt, returned a wallet to his back trouser pocket. A moment later, the door opened again, and somehow it didn't surprise me at all to see that same boy emerge from inside, his hair bleached into some unnatural hybrid of brown and blonde. Deerstalker laid his hand down on the boy's shoulder in a paternal gesture, before shaking Man United's hand. And when he raised his arm in the air, a taxi appeared immediately, and the boy and his client climbed into the back seat before driving away. After they departed, he glanced across the street, and our eyes met for a moment. He stared at me, cold and bellicose, and I turned away, happy to see my friend walking towards me now with a smile on her face. The Anger of the Exile. When I first became familiar with Amsterdam, I found myself increasingly drawn to those parts of the city that offered art galleries and curiosity shops, bookstores and street artists. I attended concerts, bought tickets to plays, and spent long afternoons in the Rijksmuseum, studying exhibition after exhibition in an attempt to broaden my mind. With almost no knowledge of the history of art, I didn't always understand what I was looking at, nor did I have the capacity to contextualize a particular painting or sculpture. But the work began to move me, and any loneliness I felt soon became tempered by developing interest in creativity. It was one of the reasons, perhaps, why I found my work at the Anne Frank House so stimulating. For inside the museum lay the stories of others and the words of one, a combination that had an unpredictable effect on every visitor who walked through its doors. I had never led a particularly cultured life in Dublin, despite the fact that I had spent my formative years in the home of a novelist and her husband. Knowing how books had formed the bedrock of Maud's life, it began to strike me as strange that she had never shown any interest in encouraging my own interest in literature. There were books in Dartmouth Square, of course, books beyond number. But not once had Maud walked me around the shelves, pointing out the novels or story collections that had first inspired her. Nor had she ever thrust any of these works into my hands, insisting that I read them so we could discuss them afterwards. And once I left that house to begin the deeply private and depressingly fraudulent existence that would characterize my third decade, I intentionally ignored anything that might draw me back to the complicated years of my childhood. The canal area between Herengracht and the River Amstel was my favourite part of the city, and I would often stop at McIntyre's pub for dinner as I made my way home from work. During my nomadic years in Europe, I had studiously avoided Irish bars, but there was something about the blend of Dutch and Irish traditions there that appealed to me. The decor reminding me of home, but the food and atmosphere being firmly rooted in the culture of somewhere entirely different. The bar was frequented primarily by gay men, but was not so much a pick-up joint as a casual hangout. Occasionally, a couple of rent boys would come in and attract the attention of the older men, sitting alone at their tables reading De Telegraaf, but unless they conducted their business quickly, the proprietor, Jack Smoot, would throw them out, directing them back towards Paardenstraat and Rembrandtplein with fiercely uttered warnings not to return. "A little trade from time to time is fine," he told me one evening after ejecting a tall, dark-haired boy in a pair of tight denim shorts that did him no favours. "But I won't allow McIntyre's to get a reputation for hustlers." "None of them are Dutch, are they?" I asked, watching the boy as he stood outside staring into the canal. His shoulders slumped in defeat. He looked Greek or Turkish to me. "Most of them are Eastern European boys," said Smoot, barely glancing outside. "They come over here to make their fortunes, but they don't have the same success as the girls. No one's interested in seeing boys posing in their underwear in a window in Divalin. They have about 5 good years, if they're lucky. Then they start to show their age, and no one cares any more. If you want him—" "Jesus," I said, retreating in my seat, offended. "Of course I don't want him. He's just a child." "But isn't there some other way he could make a living? He looked as if he's starving."
It probably is.
So why throw him out? At least he would have made enough to eat tonight.
Because if I let one do it, then I have to let them all do it, said Smoot. And I didn't set this place up to be a haven for rent boys.
He wouldn't have approved of that.
Who wouldn't? I asked. But he ignored my question and returned behind the bar, washing his hands in the sink and ignoring me for the rest of the night. I'd grown friendly with Jack Smoot ever since I'd started frequenting McIntyre's. He was about 20 years older than me, and an intimidating presence with his shaven head, eye patch, and a walking stick that supported a lame left leg. Once, when I stayed late on a Friday night with a girl I was friendly with from work, he invited me to spend the night with him in his flat upstairs, but I declined, and he seemed more upset by my rejection than I had expected him to be, for I assumed that he hit on his regulars frequently, sometimes successfully, sometimes not. I made sure to return the next night, hoping that things would not be awkward between us, and to my relief he behaved as if nothing untoward had happened. Now he usually left me alone to enjoy my dinner, but would sometimes join me for a drink before I left for home, and it was on one such occasion that he surprised me by revealing himself to be Irish.
"Well, half Irish," he said, correcting himself. "I was born there, but I got out of the place when I was 20.
"You've no trace of an accent," I told him.
"I worked hard to get rid of it,"
he said, tapping on the table nervously with badly chewed nails.
"Where are you from?" "Out near Ballincollig," he said, looking away, his tongue bulging in his cheek.
I could feel his entire body tensing beside me.
"Where's that?
Kerry?"
"Cork."
"Oh, right," I said. "I've never been there."
"Well, you haven't missed much. And do you go back often?"
He laughed, as if I had asked a ridiculous question, and shook his head.
"I do not," he said.
"I haven't set foot in Ireland in 35 years, and it would take an army of mercenaries to drag me back there now. Awful country. Horrible people. Terrible memories."
"And yet," I said, a little unsettled by his bitterness, "you run an Irish bar."
"I run an Irish bar because it makes money," he told me. "This place is a little gold mine."
"I may hate the country, Cyril, but I don't mind her people coming over here and putting money in my till. And once in a while someone comes in and there's something in his voice or his expression that..."
He trailed off and shook his head before closing his eyes, and I could tell that whatever scars lingered from his past, there was little chance of them ever healing.
"What?"
I asked, when he showed no signs of continuing.
"Something that what?"
"Something that reminds me of a boy I used to know," he said, looking up with a half-smile. And I decided to ask no more questions. Whatever his memories were, they were private ones and no business of mine.
"Anyway, I admire people like you, Cyril," he said finally. "People who got away. It's the ones who've stayed that I despise. The tourists who come over here on Friday mornings on the first Aer Lingus flight with no plans other than to drink themselves stupid, then make their way to the Rossa Boat to get laid. Although by then they're usually too drunk to get it up anyway. Then they leave again on Sunday afternoon, back to their civil service jobs with Monday morning hangovers, convinced that the whores enjoyed the 5 minutes they spent with them just because they smiled through it all and gave them a kiss when they were leaving. I bet you never see a group of Irish tourists in the Anne Frank house."
"Not often," I admitted.
"That's because they're all in here, or places like this. You know, I worked for the civil service when I was younger," I told him.
"I'm only half surprised to hear you say it," he said.
"But you left, so you mustn't have enjoyed it."
"It was all right. The truth is, I might be still there today if... Well, there was an incident, and there was no staying on after that. I didn't care much, to be honest. I got a job in RTE, and that was more interesting."
Smoot took a sip from his drink and glanced out the window, watching as the bicycles went past, an occasional bell ringing in the air to warn a careless pedestrian.
"Funnily enough," he said, "I know someone who works in the Dáil.
A TD? No, a woman.
There are women TDs, I said.
Are there?
Of course there are, you sexist pig.